This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include Chatham County will see more suburbs, and the internets.org registry is snatched up by a private equity firm. And we'll begin with Chatham County will see more suburbs. Chatham County, once known as mostly rural and undeveloped, will see its newer suburban elements increase with the first mid-rise multifamily apartment complex of its kind on the U.S. 15501 corridor. Briar Chapel developer Newland and Raleigh-based real estate investors Blue Heron Asset Management are planning and designing a 200-unit apartment complex across three 4- to 5-story buildings with amenities and a clubhouse building. Working on it is slated to begin in the first quarter of 2020. It will be part of the vast Briar Chapel residential community of 1,900 homes. Its neighboring development, Chatham Park in Pittsburgh, is predicted to bring nearly 60,000 more people to the county. Briar Chapel doesn't have market-rate apartments. It's a segment that's missing, and it hits multiple buyer categories, said Mike Skiscani, Vice President of Operations for Newland. They're for people who are just moving to the area, who are renting before they buy, or people who are renting by choice. But I also think it adds an additional segment that's uniquely missing that might attract new folks, new buyers, and new shoppers. The apartments would range from 1 to 3 bedrooms. Rent estimates aren't available yet. This is the second multifamily development coming to Briar Chapel after 150 assisted living units for seniors were announced earlier this year. Its zoning only allows up to 350 multifamily units on the development, which will be fulfilled with the completion of both the senior and apartment housing. Skiscani emphasize that Briar Chapel isn't as dense as other developments, since around half of the overall development is planned to be green space. Our hope is that we're not something foreign to Chatham County, and that what we're building responds to the place along with the environment and the architecture that surrounds it, said Kevin Wade, a senior associate for Blue Heron. We're not interested in being a foreigner and upending what's already there. Briar Chapel is zoned for 2,700 homes. More residential and commercial development is expected, including a grocery store. Chatham County has seen changes as its triangle neighbors Wake, Durham, and Orange counties have grown rapidly. Residential growth has spilled over from Durham to the north and Cary and Apex to the east. The nearly decade-old Briar Chapel has been a big driver of growth there and led to the County Commission's development of countywide zoning rules and the Chatham Plan, which guides growth and development in the area. In a questionnaire to Chapel Hill Council candidates from the News and Observer prior to November elections, they all said they supported more mid-rise multifamily housing in the town where zoning is allowed. Recent data from real estate research firm Metro study say Briar Chapel is the third most active residential community in the Triangle, with 197 annual housing starts and 239 closings, as well as 596 future homes. Next, the internets.org registry is snatched up by a private equity firm. The old dream of an internet run in the public interest has long dissipated under pressure from huge corporations seeking to profit from what has become a worldwide information utility. But one corner of the web seemed to maintain its character as a preserve for public service, the .org domain, which since its creation has been reserved for nonprofit organizations and has become something of a badge of honor for non-commercial activity. That's why many in the nonprofit world were startled by the announcement on November 13th that the .org registry had been sold to a private equity firm, Ethos Capital. The seller was the Internet Society, a nonprofit that plays an important role in creating and maintaining Internet engineering standards, but has been mostly the guardian of the .org domain. The price, as was revealed more than 2 weeks later, was a stunning $1.135 billion. In the original announcement, Internet Society Chief Executive Andrew Sullivan called the sale an important and exciting development and described Ethos as a strong strategic partner that understands the intricacies of the domain industry. Others are not so sure. Ethos didn't even exist until earlier this year and currently appears to have only two employees, including Eric Brooks, its founder. Brooks describes his investment principles as intellectual honesty, humility, and respect, and believing that prosperity can be built together, as he listed them for me by email. But a week after the sale announcement, it emerged that the financial backers of Ethos included several firms with more conventional investment approaches, including funds associated with the families of H. Ross Perot, Mitt Romney, and the Johnsons, owners of Fidelity Investments. Brooks says Ethos is committed to running the .org registry in accordance with principles followed by the Internet Society, but hasn't made that commitment in writing. At stake are Internet addresses ending in .org, used by some 10 million organizations. The .org designation or domain is one of the oldest on the Internet, along with .com for commercial businesses, .edu, educational institutions, .gov, government agencies, and a handful of others. It's traditionally reserved for nonprofit organizations devoted to the public interest, such as the Red Cross and the Girl Scouts and the United Way. Not every .org meets the public service standards since applicants aren't screened. Websites for political fronts such as the Koch Network, Americans for Prosperity, carry the .org label. So do sites for neo-Nazi hate groups. But for the most part, organizations genuinely aimed at doing good tend to choose .org addresses. And for that matter, so do Democratic and Republican Party websites. The domain holds a special place in the hearts of Internet users, environmentalist and Internet activist Jacob Malthouse. He calls .org a digital Yosemite, evoking the reverence naturalists such as John Muir felt for the real thing. During a recent online discussion on the sale, John Nevitt, chief executive of the Public Interest Registry, or PIR, the Internet Society unit that manages .org and is the entity being sold to Ethos, called it the crown jewel of the domain name system, full stop. The sale, which is expected to close in the first quarter of next year, could be derailed only by two entities. One is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, the web's Playa Vista-based governing body, which could rule on the transfer any day now. The other is Pennsylvania Orphans Court, which has jurisdiction because PIR is a nonprofit incorporated in that state. In the meantime, the deal has drawn brickbats from several internet luminaries. They include Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, who tweeted that it would be a travesty if the .org domain were no longer operated in the public interest. Also weighing in was Esther Dyson, the founding chairman of ICANN, who tweeted that she was appalled at what she called the greatest .org heist. The parties involved in the sale have tried to tamp down the controversy without notable success. On November 29th, Sullivan and Gonzalo Camarillo, the Internet Society chair, held a conference call with users to defend the deal. That was followed by a web discussion on December 5th hosted by NTEN, an advocacy group for nonprofits, at which Sullivan was joined by Brooks and Nevitt. Brooks said he was committed to operating PIR in the .org community's interest, but was vague about the mechanism that would be established to do so. He said Ethos would not be making its financial data public, unlike the Internet Society, which issues an annual financial disclosure. The .org community has two main concerns about the sale. One is that Ethos will jack up the registration fee for .org websites, which is currently about $10 per year and has been subject to a traditional limit on increases of 10% a year. More important may be Ethos's ability to facilitate more censorship of .org websites by allowing third parties more latitude to object to content on those sites and prompt their shutdown. The .org registry is a point of control on the Internet, said Mitch Stoltz, an attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which has launched a campaign protesting the deal. A private equity firm has an incentive to sell censorship as a service. Already, registrars of other domains have cut agreements with corporate players such as Motion Picture Association of America, giving them the authority to order shutdowns of sites they claim are infringing on copyrights without affording site owners the opportunities to appeal. As the owner of the .org domain, Stoltz observes, Ethos could enforce any limitations on nonprofit speech. Since many nonprofit organizations are engaged in speech that seeks to hold governments and industry to account, those powerful interests have every incentive to buy the cooperation of a well-placed intermediary, including an Ethos-owned PIR. Commerce has infiltrated virtually every corner of the web except, up to now, the nonprofit corner represented by .orgs. The implication of the .org sale is that no piece of the Internet is, in fact, immune from the world of getting and spending. Everything is for sale. The public interest be damned. Next, employers say they need more immigrants. After finishing a particularly satisfying dinner at a Coral Gables, Florida restaurant with his wife, Pedro Martinez quietly slipped around to the back alley where the kitchen is. "Whatever you're making, I will give you a raise," Martinez whispered when the back door swung open. An executive at 50 Eggs, a restaurant group based in Miami, Martinez is always ready with a stack of business cards for occasions like this. As unemployment rates nationwide have sunk to record lows, filching workers has become routine. In cities that are magnets for immigrants, newcomers have filled some job openings, but employers across several industries and states insist that many more are needed for their businesses to function, let alone grow. The economic effect is just one facet of an immigration debate that vibrates with political and moral import, challenging ideas about America's identity and culture. But it is also one that can be examined more dispassionately by looking at the numbers. And the numbers, most economists say, indicate there is plenty of room. Immigrants make the country richer, they argue. Without immigration, we shrink as a nation, said Douglas Holtz Eakin, a former director of the Congressional Budget Office, who has advised Republican presidential candidates and now leads the Conservative American Action Forum. That's because growth is driven by two ingredients: the size of the workforce and how efficiently those workers produce things, and both are creeping well behind the post-war average. One reason is that Americans are having fewer babies. Birth rates fell last year to a three-decade low, ensuring that the next generation of native-born Americans will be smaller than the current one. The result is fewer workers and consumers, fewer houses to build, phones to sell, and cars to buy, fewer gains all around. Turn away new immigrants and the picture darkens considerably. Using census data, an investment company, the Blackstone Group, estimates that without immigration, the working age population between 25 and 64 years old would drop by 17 million by 2035. We really need immigrants, Byron R. Wine, vice chairman of Blackstone's Private Wealth Solutions Group, said during the company's quarterly webcast last month. If we have a shrinking population, it's going to be tough to have rising GDP or gross domestic product. At the moment, there are 7.3 million job openings nationwide and 6 million people unemployed. That gap is expected to widen as the number of retirees grows faster than the number of new workers. In every market that we're in, we're dealing with staffing shortages, said Pilar Carvajal, founder and chief executive of Innovation Senior Management, which manages 7 assisted living centers in Florida. Entry-level workers in the area make from $10 to $12 an hour, the same as a dishwasher, and slightly more than a farm worker. She has turned away business, declining to manage properties elsewhere. It's a staffing void, she confided during a visit to a memory care center in Broward County. Employment agencies won't even return phone calls. Thank God we have immigrants coming in, she said. We're hiring them as fast as they come. More than 1 million immigrants enter the United States every year, most of them through authorized channels. Altogether, there are more than 44 million immigrants, or 13.6% of the population. The share is significantly higher than it was in 1970, but below the peak in the 1890s when millions of Europeans crossed the Atlantic Ocean. President Donald Trump has publicly resisted the argument that the nation needs more immigrants. Our country is full, he said during a visit to the border this spring. We can't take any more. But in May, Trump proposed revamping legal immigration without reducing the overall level by giving preference to immigrants with skills, education, and job offers instead of people with family ties. There is no way to figure out precisely how many more immigrants the national economy could easily absorb without a lot of guessing. Powerful forces like technology, globalization, and the decline in union strength can heave economies around willy-nilly, benefiting some workers and hurting others, regardless of immigration. Despite a decade-long expansion and a low official jobless rate, the income gap is widening and many Americans struggle to find stable employment and middle-class wages. A common complaint is that immigrants snatch jobs from native-born Americans, particularly those who did not finish high school. This group is already more likely to earn the minimum wage or be out of work. There is scattershot evidence that in some places, immigrants can press down wages at the lowest end of the economic scale, but that is not typical. Immigrants take jobs, but they also help create jobs by generating demand for goods and services like groceries, haircuts, and homes. More often, economists say immigrants complement U.S. workers. More educated women, for example, may decide to work if the availability of immigrants make child care more affordable. And many tasks that most people previously did themselves, mowing lawns, polishing nails, picking up takeout, driving, are now contracted out because there is labor to do them. The middle class is afforded some luxuries that only the affluent could afford in the past because of immigration, said Muzaffar Shazidi, director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at New York University School of Law. If people are prepared to adjust their needs, we don't need as many immigrants. Choices about how to provide essential services and compensate workers are not just economic but political as well. Chisiti pointed out, should the government spend more on training, offer workers incentives to relocate, subsidize elder care, protect workers' bargaining power, or help build affordable housing so that low-wage workers can cover basic expenses? What happens now is that migrants tend to fill jobs that citizens do not want to take for the pay offered, and they are much more willing to move to a new city or state for a job. Significantly higher wages might attract more native-born workers to the service jobs that many immigrants occupy in health care, housekeeping, or hothouses. But if labor costs raise the price of tomatoes or a manicure, people will purchase fewer of them. Push-up costs too much, and some jobs might disappear or move to other countries. Overall, income and production would shrink. Too many workers, complaints about a labor shortage ring hollow when companies are earning record profits and giving executives multi-million-dollar paychecks while offering workers meager raises. Several businesses, though, have much slimmer profits. Nationwide, for example, restaurant profit margins average 3% to 5%. At one of 50 Egg's busiest restaurants in Miami, Yardbird Southern Table and Bar, roughly 80% of the staff members were born abroad. The idea that legal immigrants are taking jobs away from residents of the U.S. is just not reality, said John Kunkel, founder and chief executive of 50 Eggs, which also operates Yardbird locations in Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Singapore. That's the armchair view of somebody who doesn't run a business. Automation, rather than higher wages, is often the response to labor shortages. When immigration restrictions in the mid-1960s dried up the pool of Mexican farm laborers, California growers started using mechanical harvesters to pick tomatoes. Next, Florence left food insecurity in its wake in eastern North Carolina. At Rose Strayhorn Bell stepped inside the disaster recovery food pantry on Tuesday before Thanksgiving, she peeled a yellow school visitor sticker off her blouse. Hurricane Florence's floodwaters caused severe damage to Strayhorn Bell's home in Pollocksville, and she's been living with her mother in Trenton since returning to Jones County 11 days after the storm. Strayhorn Bell likened her change in living situations to moving out of the large can into the sardine can. Substitute teaching is part of her effort to move back out. "I'm just here to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving," Strayhorn Bell said, greeting the volunteers sitting around folding tables set up to make a U-shape around the room. From behind a pile of bags of Coco Roux cereal, Rebecca Bain Sissy, who oversees the pantry, said, "You're not going to pick up anything today?" "If I do, I'll probably pick up more cereal," Strayhorn Bell said. But after making her way around the table, Strayhorn Bell carried two plastic grocery bags, one laden with canned goods. The Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina's Trenton Pantry, the first of its kind set up by the food bank itself, represents one of many efforts throughout the state to address the lingering effect of Hurricane Florence and is having on food security. While about 720,000 people received temporary disaster food benefits in the 3 months following Florence, state and federal programs addressing food security often are geared toward the immediate aftermath of a disaster, not the long-term recovery. And that has left a mixture of nonprofits, volunteers, and officials trying to fill the holes the storm blew through the pocketbooks, even as survivors scramble to save every dime to rebuild. The food bank distributed 15 million pounds of food, water, and supplies for disaster relief in the first year after Florence, according to a report from the nonprofit. And Natalie Johnson launched the Pender Food Project after Florence, cooking donated food in her home kitchen and delivering meals to families living in rural areas around Bergall. "The more nourishment people get, the more motivated they are to tackle the really difficult task of fighting for insurance, fighting for contractors to fix their homes, and fighting with the county for permits," Johnson said. "Food is as good a baseline, so is key." We have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.